Hi everyone, I'm Megan, and welcome to Word Crash, the game show where questionable plots compete for your vote to win a place in the Word Crash Hall of Infamy. Let's meet our contestants. First off, from Chicago, Illinois, an author who blends cute and cuddly with acceptance and pride, welcome back to the show, Austin Crowder.
Hello everybody, pleasure to be here.
Next, fresh from toiling in the YouTube mines, she's an author, podcaster, and Grand Moff of the Council of Geeks, please welcome Vera Wild.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, nothing left to do but get to it. Let's play Word Crash. Be prepared for surprises, subversion, and shattered expectations. It's time for Trope Nope. In this game, we challenge our contestants to tell a story while trying to avoid the most common tropes we all know and love. Austin, what are we subverting today?
Ooh, so I kind of went for Trope Tease and then Trope Nope. This is a corporate boardroom drama. Of course, as with every good lesbian love story, it begins at a softball game. Particularly, the corporate softball game, in which two of the members of the board of directors are on opposite teams. We're watching our protagonist, Jean, and our love interest, Colette, look at each other over the mound as they pitch and catch in this intense game of softball. And afterwards, they meet each other out in the parking lot and begin kind of a flirty and steamy relationship that extends into the boardroom of the corporate board of directors.
So they see each other at the softball game, which is very on brand. Did they know each other before, or is someone the new person in town?
Excellent question. Jean actually has recently joined the board of directors of this corporation. We're still going through employee orientation. We're still meeting the rest of the board. This is the, like, icebreaker that they've chosen, and these two have locked eyes over the mound.
Are we going for instant connection, or are we having some initial tension or potential professional rivalry at all?
Oh, no. 100% love at first sight. Like, I saw her sinker pitch, and I knew this was the girl I was going to adopt a cat with.
Adopt a cat with. Okay, Vera, what's this company do?
Sorry. My gut instinct is to say slowly destroy the planet and unravel democracy. But I suppose you want something a little bit more specific than that, because that's what all corporations do. Heck with it. Why don't we go hot and button topic? Why don't we have this be a video game company, and one of the major issues before the board is whether or not to integrate NFT gaming.
Okay, getting very topical here. Let's name this company so that we can talk about it. We'll call it Sometime Soft. No, that's terrible.
No, that's great, because that's like a vaguely penis joke in a lesbian romance. I kind of love it.
Oh, God. Okay. Their employees at Neversoft, not Neversoft, I'm sorry, Sometime Soft.
I'm gonna go back and just say, this obviously implies that Jean is trans, so here we are.
For it, I'm for it, I love it.
Newly appointed to the board of directors, which is pretty amazing. Are they the only two women on the board of directors?
There's a lot of women on this board of directors. They're actually surprisingly progressive, and that's the reason that Jean joined the company. And they, in fact, mention it at the softball game. So we're really, like, leaning into this lesbian joke. Like, man, there's a lot of women on this board of directors. Like, we can field an entire women's softball team with our corporate board? Wow.
That's a good trope dodge, because we're avoiding the woman trying to make her way in a man's world thing. I like it.
So what things are we going to bring into this? Is there a will-they-won't-they tension? Is there a does-she-want-me-or-not tension?
A little bit of both. I think there's a will-we-won't-we as they, like, pass love letters across the corporate campus. And then a happy hour turns super steamy, where they go out for drinks and they say, wouldn't it be crazy if we, like, went home together? Immediate slam cut. We have our, like, sex scene. Jean wakes up the next morning and sees pictures in the hallway and is like, who's she? And Colette responds, oh, yeah, that's my girlfriend. And Jean, the embarrassed Midwestern prude that she is, says nothing, but thinks that she has just helped Colette cheat on this beautiful woman in these pictures. Spoiler, the girlfriend is also part of the board of directors, and it's someone we've already seen. This all culminates in 6 months of sex and cloak and daggery as she's trying to figure out, like, what's going on here? How can I tell her?
So Jean is like thinking about, you know, looking into this, doing Facebook stalking and all that stuff, and is continuing to sleep with her that whole time.
Jean, the moral thing for me to do right now is to figure out if this person's cheating. My body is not ready to follow my moral compass.
I'm not getting judgy on Jean. I just wanted to be sure that we had a base covered there because he kind of glossed over it. I was like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I'm missing something.
That's really interesting because now we've added a whole dynamic to Jean that Jean has like not dated in many years because of transition and figuring their stuff out.
You could even have it that she hasn't even dated as a woman yet.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, my God. Absolutely.
And this is one of those things where the acceptance is enough for them to question their own morals.
Yeah.
You know, this is great, but what's going on? But somebody wants me. But what's going on? But somebody wants me. Right. And that's a totally different story than your typical love story. So it's like, oh, everything's sweet. Oh, they're going to leave their other partner for me. No. No, it's just, I know this thing, but I want love. What are those first interactions like? Vera, how do they get to those love letters?
One of them's going to have to initiate on that. And like, I'm thinking actual physical love letters. Because you send emails over the company servers, that's how you get fired. So we're not doing that. We're not pulling a 50 Shades of Grey and doing all kinds of stuff that should have these people ejected from this business. It is going to have to be physical letters. I feel like Colette's going to have to make the first move and take the initiation and just leaving a note, a little folded note on Jean's desk. And that's the initiation and where it starts. And then it becomes a matter of, it almost becomes like a little espionage montage as they try and get and sneak into the other one's office when they're not there to leave a note. So that when the other one gets back to their office, there it is. And the notes themselves can become more elaborate, not just in terms of what is said in them, but like get to the point of this vintage style paper with a wax seal on it. And it starts getting just more and more elaborate, both in how the notes get placed and the nature of the notes themselves.
Austin, what is it about Colette that Jean thinks is fantastic? Is it just physical?
Oh, no. Colette is definitely the woman who gets what she wants. Simple as that. She walks into a boardroom. You can hear her heels clicking on the hardwood floor, and everyone snaps to attention. She walks up to the front of the room, projects confidence, and just this kind of sex appeal of, I am a corporate woman, and I am in control of this room. And Jean wants that control pointed in her direction.
Vera, what's the ramifications that Jean thinks will happen if they get caught? Because Jean has got to be like wrestling with something.
Given the ending that we're building to.
Editor's note, I put the end at the end. So you're just going to have to deal with it.
I feel like most of the, and this could even count as your trope subversion, most of the traditional conflict and worries is going to be almost entirely in Jean's head. Because the normal things that would come up, like, what if we get caught? What if I get fired? What if this? What if that? Like, the reality is none of this applies. But Jean doesn't know that. And so you can have a lot of the standard points of tension and stress, but they're just in her head, as opposed to an external force that she's having to work around. She is having to literally talk herself down and around all these problems that she doesn't realize don't actually exist and are not actually hurdles.
So these things that aren't actually hurdles that she's trying to work her way through, is she actually successful or does everyone just know?
The you sweet summer child treatment?
Everybody knows, but not everyone knows in the same way. So like when you get to the end and he gets reveals, like everybody knows what the heck's going on and like is not only cool with it, it's like, yeah, this is kind of the deal. They could almost go around the boardroom and be like, oh, I didn't buy it at all when you made up this excuse saying that you were going to lunch with this person. And someone else will, oh, well, I figured it out when you tried to do this and I didn't buy it. And just go down the line of all the different stuff that she was paranoid about, which was a different point for a different member of the board to realize, ah, yeah, I see through that. But each of them figure it out because of a different thing she failed to properly cover for.
Nobody needs that many pens. Every day you were like, oh, I'm turning her pen.
Yes. This is clumsily stumbling your way through love. That's what this is.
Because this has a romantic plot, we need a non-romantic subplot. We need to flip this on its head. What game are they building?
I would say it would be a female-targeted, procedurally generated dating sim where the potential romantic interests are all NFTs on blockchain, meaning they're all completely unique. And if you are not getting along with this one, you have to shell out for a new boyfriend. That is the monetization model for this game.
So you're saying it's like Boyfriend Dungeon, but you have to buy the partners?
Yes.
That you may have?
Yes.
So it's Pokemon.
It's dating Pokemon.
And we have to have a recurring revenue model. You can have one date because these are non-fungible boyfriends. You get yourself an NFT and then you go on a date with them. And if you screw up, they don't date you. And they return to the dating pool and you have to pull the thing again to get another possible date. And if you get one that's really attractive, it's worth a lot of money because you have to make the line go up. That's a very important thing with NFTs. So like you're chasing that more valuable and more valuable and more valuable girlfriends, which echoes Jean's struggle to find her own self-worth as a trans person who's just starting to date women and feels like she's not good enough for the women around her. So now we've got like a theme.
She worries that she sees herself in the low grade starter level. Oh, I don't want this one. Trade it. Get me something else. She thinks that's what she is in her own head.
I can just imagine a dream sequence now of being stuck on one of those line graphs that are going up and they're just stuck as it bobs up and down and bobs up and down. They're like, ah. Let's get a little bit more into what that final set piece looks like.
I'm thinking we are going to have to go semi-nature, like view of nature, not actually out in nature. We're too high-end in corporate for that. This is a completely overly cushiony, you know, spa rooms and everybody has central air and like it's completely pampered. But look out that window where out of the room where we're eating our meals every day and look at that view. Look at all that nature right there on the other side of that glass in that window we don't plan to open.
It's pretty of staying inside.
I may have been on corporate retreats in my life.
I also have been on corporate retreat. I equal the sentiment that was motioned, but not actually vocalized, that kind of looked like you were throwing up.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
In COVID times, they now do virtual corporate retreats, and it's the worst of every single world that you could possibly manifest.
Oh, God, no.
I have not been on one of those yet.
I'm so happy to be self-employed. Oh my God. I mean, my boss is a jerk, but still.
Well, that's why I said you were toiling in the YouTube mines.
And I will continue to. It's not a particularly profitable vein of income, but I hit it. So I'm going to mine the crap out of it.
Ride it while you got it.
What is it that pushes Jean to finally get up and say, this is enough, I can't handle this? There's got to be something, their darkest point, they hit it, something that totally just pushes them over the edge. Now they have to declare to everybody that this is terrible.
We're at the corporate retreat and Colette and her girlfriend are there and they are super lovey-dovey. They're hanging on each other, kissing each other. They're like just so very obviously in love. And Jean tries her best to say, it's fine, I don't have to bring this up here. But as she gets more and more jealous of the love that they're showing each other at this place and feeling like she can't express that love to Colette, she blows up.
Boom. I'm envisioning now that final instant where Jean snaps, right? And there's karaoke going on. And she just runs up and she grabs the karaoke mic and she's like, I have an announcement to make. I have to talk about something. It's very important to me.
I'm imagining her as you, like you say that the karaoke's happening by the very large landscape window that Vera mentioned. She's like, I'm going to cool down. I'm going to look at nature. And then Colette's girlfriend, what's a really good lesbian love song?
It's got to be something from the 80s. It's got to be kind of like a rock ballad thing.
Mm-hmm.
My brain has immediately gone to Heaven is a Place on Earth because I'm latching on to San Junipero from Black Mirror.
That's perfect.
Oh, yes. That's it. That's it.
The only episode of Black Mirror that I've seen because I was told it was required.
It's the best one. It's a good show, but that is the best episode, and also not typical of the show, because the show will freaking break you and laugh.
Well, do not watch the first episode of Electric Sheep. That's very disappointing. It's a fantastic twist to the everything, but it's a little...
I gave that thing two episodes, and I'm like, I don't love this. It's tough. Anthology format is tough.
I've never done it.
So I'm imagining, based on that, Colette's girlfriend is singing Heaven is a Place on Earth, and Colette jumps on stage and they're dancing on stage and singing together and laughing. And that's the thing that blows Jean's stack. And she marches up onto stage and steals the mic. It's like, this woman is cheating on her girlfriend with me!
And I let it happen because she made me feel sexy in a way I've never been. And I needed that in my life. And I knew it was wrong. And I still did it. And just keep going. It's got to be at least a full minute continuous unbroken.
Oh, yeah. A minute or two minute long monologue where she gets to the point that she's shrieking mad. And then there's silence. And then there's laughter.
Did you just drop a surprise polyamory twist on us?
You can't take that away from me. Jean just unloads on Colette. And then the entire board of directors looks at each other and laughs and just says, oh, honey, we're one big messy polycule here in the corporate board of directors.
The whole board of directors is one polycule.
I didn't mean to jump the gun on your twist. It's just like the people I know, my head went there immediately.
Love it. Perfect. No notes.
Uproarious laughter and clapping. It's got to be a lot of clapping and laughter. Like, oh, you totally got us. That's great. You're so silly. And I'd love to see one person stand up and explain. And it's got to be someone in authority. It can't be Colette. It can't be her girlfriend. There's got to be someone that Jean respects enough to believe when she's told.
Obviously, this would have to be someone established prior to this, but whoever is the chairperson of the board should take lead on this, because that is the person who would have no need to jerk Jean around. Clearly, there was something that we thought you got that you didn't get. Let's lay something out here.
The chairman of the board walks up and says, did you read your onboarding packet? And there's this, like, slam cut to, make sure you read the onboarding packet. Yeah, sure. Throws it in the trash.
Two or three other times, people have got to remind her to read the onboarding packet.
Yeah.
It's got to come up, right? Especially when someone catches her and she thinks she gets away with it. They're always like, oh, hey, yeah, and did you read the onboarding packet? Sure, sure.
Yeah, no, I totally did. Okay. All right, just being sure, because all right, cool. If you read it, fine.
Cool. We thought you all read it. You said you had read the onboarding packet, so we were just, like, letting you do your thing with Colette. Like, it was in the onboarding packet.
And the moral to this story is always read your onboarding packet.
Truth.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's time for Secret Sauce, where our authors share a technique or strategy they use to keep the creative juices flowing. Vera, what do you have for us today?
Well, for me, as someone with ADHD, my issue is not having the creative juices flowing, it is having them focus on one frickin' thing and stay there. So specifically when it comes to writing, it's a couple of steps all to accomplish the same thing, which is to basically remove other distractions. So I have two places in the house that I will go to write. In nicer weather, in the summer, I'll go and sit on the porch. Otherwise, I have a room that I sit in, and it's a room that I don't do much else in other than read or write. And I get out my Chromebook, which I do not really use for anything other than writing. And I leave my phone out of reach. So I need to be in spaces where I'm not used to doing something other than writing, on a tool that I don't use for things other than writing. And that will usually get me focused to actually get some writing done, because I'm not going to say it's impossible for me to do writing at my computer, but it's going to be in very short bursts, broken up frequently by checking Twitter or TikTok or any number of a bajillion freaking other things, because my brain is going, ooh, you didn't check this. What's this? Is there an update on this? Something you want? I need to remove the option. That's ultimately what it comes down to. I need to remove my other options.
That's not so far-fetched. I hear a lot of authors talk about that, even if they're not ADHD. I wrote the majority of my first book on the train ride between the suburbs and Chicago.
So I feel like I can actually share this now that I'm self-employed and I was laid off from this company that I hated anyways. The vast majority of my three published works were written on the job, because what I actually had to do to accomplish what I was supposed to do for my job did not require my full attention or my full time. But if you start futzing around on your phone or you're pulling up YouTube videos at your desk, people are going to notice. If you're just typing, if you're just writing in a Word document, they assume you're working. So my first published book, which is semi-autobiographical, my two-act play, and my novel were all written partially, or in the case of the first two, almost completely while on the job. Because I hated that job and I was bored.
I am going to plus one that. The first two books that I published were written on the job. Same thing. It wasn't that I underperformed at that job. It was just I was bored and I didn't have anything else to do. So, you know, it was very easy for me to crank out 1,000 words a day. In one of those extra hours where I wasn't doing anything, I'd just pull up Q10, which was my favorite text editor back in the day, and bang out 1,000 words. And you do that long enough and you've got a novel.
You know, it's funny, like, because you're required to sit there for 8 hours, but most jobs do not have 8 hours worth of stuff for you to do 5 days a week. I mean, that, and that's just being honest. That's even if you like your job, you probably don't have 8 hours of actual work to do.
I mean, I have 10 to 15 hours worth of work to do in a day.
There are exceptions, and my heart goes out to anyone for whom those are the exceptions. But, you know, as someone who's pushing 40 and going by my own work experience, there was rarely 8 hours worth of work in an 8-hour day.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty high up on my career ladder as an Agile coach, and there are many days where I just have 4 hours where there's not much I can do. It's just I'm there, I'm marking time, and I'm listening to like my Slack to make sure that nothing blows up. Why not write during that time?
Why not? Indeed. I mean, other than technically the company owns what you write on their time while they're paying you, but we won't tell them who you're working for at the time.
Doesn't matter anymore anyway. I signed the severance agreements. They don't have crap.
So this is the tip. Write stuff while you're on the job.
You're not wrong.
One trick. Corporate employers hate it.
I'm not officially endorsing that. I am saying it works.
I would like to say for my current employer, in case anyone's listening to this podcast, that was all in the past, and I never write on the job anymore.
Speaking of which, Austin, what do you have for us today for your tip or trick that is not write your book on the job? I mean, which of course you don't do.
Of course I don't. You know what? I'm going to go with the mental health Ben Lake Vera did. I live with dissociative identity disorder, which means that I have a lot of difficulty focusing on doing one thing because there's a lot of people in my head who want to do different things. And so for me slash us, it's a question of intentionality. Like, I have to get everybody on board inside and build that commitment to, I am going to start writing this thing. I'm going to write this novel. I'm going to write this novella. And if I'm going to start writing this novella, I am going to finish this novella, even if it turns out crap, even if I don't like where it ends up. Like, I am committing to finishing this piece of work. Heinlein is not exactly the most glowing example of writing, but his rules for writing are very good and clear. Like, if you start something, you finish something. And getting to a place where I accepted that and I didn't just say, I hate this and I'm tossing it out, has been very important. A lot of times we end up as writers getting halfway through a work and seeing all of the flaws and saying, this is just not going to work. I don't see my way out of this. But if you continue to write, even though you don't see the way out, that is how you end up with these incredible plot twists, these incredible narrative beats that you never thought were possible. You've written yourself into a corner, you find a way out, and that is the stuff that makes your work interesting and great.
I just ran into that exact thing a couple weeks ago. I'm working on my follow-up to my first book, Chromospace Renegade, and I had a plot. I knew where I wanted to be in the end. I couldn't get everyone into that same place, and so I decided to make a bold choice to make that happen. And I love that bold choice now. I love it. We were going in a direction. I'm like, you know what? You know what needs to happen? I need to subvert some expectations. And boom, it's falling into place now. It'll take me another year to finish it, at least at this point. But hey, at least I know that I can get there.
Can I offer something? And I know this breaks your format a little bit, but an interesting pro tip that I picked up and started using.
Sure.
A author on Twitter, and I unfortunately don't remember the person, shared one of their drafting skills, which is if you feel stuck, like you have a good scene and then you want to get to another good scene, but you don't know how to get there. He types in with like caret brackets on either side, get there. They get there. And the idea behind it is instead of breaking your flow and trying to like go off and think about, oh gosh, how do I get from point A to point B? Save that for the revision. You're hot. You know what you want to do next. Type in a caret and a caret and just say, get there. And then in your revision process, you sit down and control F for all of the get there's and write those connecting pieces after you've seen the entire novel. I've done a bit of that in my own drafting, and it's been really effective for keeping me in the moment and keeping me from self-editing.
It's funny because I don't know if this is anything I'd offer as a general piece of advice, but I know for me personally, I have never finished a piece of any length where I didn't know going in how it was going to end. I can't freeform write, and I have dear friends who are like, you know, I'm going to let the characters write this. I'll see where it goes. Like, I can't. I have to know where I'm going. And it's not that I get completely stuck, but I lose that focus if I don't have a destination. If I know where I'm going to get eventually, then I can find the energy to get there sooner or later. But if I don't know, then eventually it's just going to peter out on me.
That's so interesting. I'm a pantser. I write by the seat of my pants. I'm the kind of writer who has a cool scene that requires 150 pages of setup. And I don't know how the story ends. And if I know how the story ends, I'm not going to write it because I'm invigorated by the act of, I don't know what's happening in this story, and the only way that I'm going to find out how it ends is if I sit down and write it. Like, I have to tell the story to myself to be interested in finishing the story.
No, it makes total sense. And like, intellectually, I can totally understand that. It's just not how my head works. Because if the possibilities are infinite, then I just freeze up. I'm like, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know where this goes. I need to be able to look, even if I'm just starting, I need to be able to look past all of the blank pages to an end point and go, no matter where this goes, I end up there. And then knowing that wherever I wander to, as long as I'm still working towards that, then I can keep going. But if I don't have eyes on that, I can't. And like, and I will do the thing of like, I have in notebooks, like isolated scenes that I've written that I may come back to, or like my first novel that I published last year started out with, I basically wrote out every major dialogue scene before I wrote out anything else. And then ended up connecting that because dialogue is kind of what comes most naturally to me. But I still needed to know what the final closer was before I could start connecting those together.
It is so fascinating to hear how other writers experience, my mentor called it the madness. Like, what is the thing that makes you sit down for 3 months and bang out 100,000 words that people may never read? It's so fascinating to hear other writers, like, reaction to the madness. Because, like, if I experienced the same thing that you did, where I'm like, I have to write the ending first, I'd be like, okay, I know how this ends. Like, I'm just going to daydream about it.
Well, that is why we are all here today. Grab your bucket and mop and get ready to put in some work. It's time for Squeaky Clean. In this game, we challenge our contestants to reboot a gritty book or movie to remove the grit. Vera, what you got?
Okay, so one of my favorite films from the last decade or so that I would consider to be gritty, because I had to think about this, because I wanted to do it with something I'd like. Because I don't like a lot of gritty stuff. And actually, it gets really old real fast. But I'll tell you what I love. I love Mad Max Fury Road. I absolutely adore the heck out of that movie. Between post-apocalypse and cars that probably get a quarter mile to the gallon because they have so much extraneous stuff on them, belching fire everywhere. And this,
yeah, that's certainly not efficient.
Yeah, no, it's the fuel efficiency, not part of this. And just this absolute swill, this toxic masculinity cult that our heroes are trying to escape for the entire movie. Like, I love it to death. And I think we should reboot it with a new setting of an arcade and go-kart. Instead of the post-apocalypse, we have an arcade where the son of the arcade owner, Immortan Joey, he kind of lords over everyone else and has special access to the one go-kart that just completely mops the floor with everybody. Nobody else gets to ride this thing. It's got a skull carved on the front of it for no reason. But, and it's, this isn't violent. He's not smashing people off the road, but absolutely dominates. But there's a new go-karter in town. Max has entered the arena and is prepared to challenge for domination of the go-karting track.
I need to know what the equivalent of the water is. Is someone just handing out quarters?
I think it's the play tokens. That is what Joey is controlling access to. And his cronies get parceled out. Just these minuscule amounts of tokens to go and play the games. He has access to as much as he wants. He'll just dole it out here and there when he feels like it.
When they're loyal to him, what kind of things does he ask them to do?
I want this to be an arcade that's like the full spectrum. Modern arcade games and retro. So it's like all across the board. I could see him having his equivalent of the War Boys grinding away at games they don't even like. But then if they get a high score, he gets to go and put his name in, even though they're the ones who worked for it.
That is evil. That is evil. That's absolutely, that's definitely kick the cat moment right there. Austin, there was an entire harem in Fury Road. What does that look like here in the arcade?
That's a really good question. One of the interesting things about the Mad Max mythos is the idea that, like, these tribes have self-organized. So I'm kind of imagining that, like, there's a harem around Gauntlet Dark Legacy, maybe. Like, glom around the machine. They all have their level 99 characters. They protect each other. If someone tries to quarter up, they kill the person who tries to quarter up. That's kind of what I'm thinking. Like, you have to have these tribes.
You could base that around any game that is best played with multiple players. So, like, the four-person brawler cabinets, like the old Simpsons or the X-Men games from the 90s.
The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle tribe.
Oh, yes.
I have a clarifying question, mm-hmm. though.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most known moments of Fury Road is that doofer guy, the guy who plays the guitar like he's the fife and drum boy to communicate moves out to the other go-karters. How is that represented within the arcade?
Okay, so what we've got is we have your Chuck E. Cheese style animatronic band. However, they have been redesigned and remade, you know, with massive mohawks and flaming decals and all this stuff. And they have dismantled what was supposed to be the lead animatronic singer and do actually have one kid who, like, has the blindfold on and sort of has that Doof Warrior look, who has taken over lead vocals with the animatronic band backing up.
So you said Spitting Fire. I think we need to do the discount version of Spitting Fire. And if you've ever been to a rock show, a discount rock show, especially discount metal show, you'll know that they use angle grinders. And they have a piece of metal and it just sparks fly everywhere. Because, of course, regulations for pyrotechnics and gasoline, it's all very dangerous. But hot bits of metal flying across the stage, that's no problem at all.
I feel like it's really important for this Fury Road remake that we nod back to the past of, like, oh, here's this guitarist who's bopping around on a bungee cord. Or here's this person who's driving around in a car that is very obviously going to fall apart when it so much as looks at an accident. We have to take every opportunity possible to bring up something dangerous and have, like, the adults in the room go, no, we're not going to do fire. Oh, did you bump that person? No. Get into the pit. Like, you're done, kiddo. Okay.
So if the go-kart track is outside, you could gear up for and, like, prep an equivalent of, like, the Sam Storm with, like, a hailstorm coming. Like, the kids are all revving up their engines, but then the adults are like, oh, no. Everyone out of your carts. Get inside. You are not racing in this.
We've done a phenomenal job with world building. I can see this in my head. I understand the politics and the back and forth of all these groups here. The big question is, though, what are they after?
It has long been forgotten, but it still technically exists, that there is a cash prize for the winner, for the top placing and the go-kart rates. Nobody pays attention to that anymore because Joey is not allowed to get it because his parents own the place, but he always wins anyway. So nobody else is ever qualified to get it. Once Max shows up, Furioso, she realizes, you know what? Between you and me, if we figure out a strategy, if we come up with something, if we work together, then we can get the cash prize and we could use that, kickstart a project to get a rival thing going. And I guarantee you everyone will abandon Joey as soon as they have an alternative.
Ah, so they're gonna take this money and they're going to go start their own arcade.
Yes, because they're kids and they don't know how business works. But if you want to have it actually play out well, you could have it that, having just arrived in town, Max's parents used to run an arcade where they lived before. And it was successful. It's just the area became depressed. And so it just wasn't going to support the business. So there was nothing wrong with the business model. They're perfectly able to run it. And so he knows that if he can get it to his parents, they could start it up.
One of the interesting lessons I learned from In the Heights, the song 96,000. If you think about it, everyone's talking about how $96,000 is going to change their life, but it's kind of like $96,000 is a lot of money, but it's not enough to like completely change your world. So I'm kind of wondering if this is one of those, like, there's a Grand Prix race and you can make $2,000. And it's kind of like a wink and a nudge to, like, I'll tell you, I own pinball machines. They're not cheap. Kind of a nod to the adults in the room of, like, these kids are going all out for $2,000 and thinking they're going to build an arcade.
So there's a big race, and we know they're going to win. They win, and they get this money, and they can't do anything they really wanted to with it. So how do they defeat Joey?
We need to settle for a spiritual win. And if the kids are generally going to this because there's nothing else to do, $2,000 will not get you start up your own arcade money. But you could throw a heck of a party and distinctly not invite Joey to it on that money. Quality snacks, bouncy castle money right there.
I love the bouncy castle. I love the bouncy castle. This is fantastic. Austin, how do they tell all the people at the arcade that there's this party now and that they're all invited, except Joey?
That's a tough one. Gosh, how do you say something in an arcade without gossip getting around? I'm kind of wondering if Joey has something that he's interested in or something that he's not happy about. Like, he's super interested in arcade high scores, but not interested in cross-stitching, right? We're going to have a cross-stitching party. We're all going to learn to cross-stitch. And, like, in the arcade, because everyone kind of hates Joey for cranking up the cost of the machines. Like, he's been... Nothing is a quarter anymore. Everything's 50 cents. Everything's a dollar. It's like, when I say cross-stitching, I mean the best party you've ever been to. There's going to be a three-story bouncy castle. That's what cross-stitching means. Pass it on.
Cross-stitching, 2 hours. Be there. I like it. I like it. So they have a fantastic party, and Joey... Does Joey show up anyways, even though he's not invited?
It could be one of the parents, or it could be an older sibling, basically serving as bouncer. Just be like, name... No, I'm Joey. I'm charging. No, not on the list. Heard you didn't like cross stitch. No, you're not going in.
You don't like cross stitch.
So do we want to go for like the revenge angle, or do we want to go for the redemption angle? Like, we all play video games. We all love go-karts. Maybe it's a Sandlot moment.
You're going to have to fill me in because I'm a bad millennial. I never saw that movie.
Well, you're wrong, and that's okay. You're wrong for not watching The Sandlot. It's cute. It's fun. It's probably not that good now that you're older. But
that's the trouble with trying to like go back to the things everyone else is nostalgic for. Like, I'm sure if I'd watched this when I was that age, I'd probably like it too.
Are we going to kick Joey completely out of the Furious party? Or are we going to be like, oh, hey, you've learned your lesson. Do you want to come play with us? Party.
Well, if we want to really go against the grain of how the original movie ended, then you would have a redemption story for him where, like, being excluded makes him realize how he was making everyone else felt. And he opens up and pulls back on the restrictions and the dictatorial nature of how the arcade was being run, which I think is the polar opposite of having your face torn off.
Yeah, this is squeaky clean. We can't have people getting their faces torn off. That's for other games that we play.
Faces must remain on faces.
So I'm envisioning this final scene that's kind of equivalent to the water that gets opened up for everybody. It just gushes down. Having seen the light doing that heel turn, Joey just dumps bags full of tokens down the slides of the bouncy castle, right? And they're going down. And everyone's rejoicing and everyone's happy.
I feel like tokens and ball pit balls, because we got to go maximum nostalgia, you know? Like, if we're going to go arcade, let's... he's brought like a ball pit.
And it's just ball pit madness.
In slow motion and the credits roll.
I like it. In fact, I probably like it better than the original movie. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Before we go, it's time to give our authors a chance to talk about what's new and exciting in their lives. Austin, what's new with you?
My new short story collection, Closet Cats, is available on Amazon Kindle Unlimited. And I'm currently working on a memoir about my experiences of living with DID.
For those who don't know what DID stands for, could you go over that a little bit?
Yeah. Dissociative identity disorder is a trauma-related disorder in which the brain doesn't form a single personality, but instead exists as a number of entities within your brain. Treating it involves getting to know all of your parts, or as they're known, alters, and making sure that those alters have what they need to feel safe, comfortable, loved, and happy. It's kind of a mess and it's very difficult to deal with, but it is an experience that I think as a writer that I have a unique perspective on and can make that experience real for people. So I'm very excited to write this.
This is probably the most personal and heartfelt story that anyone has brought up here on the podcast. And I wish you the best of luck with this. And I hope it helps.
Thanks kindly.
So where can people find you on the internet? And what else have you written?
You can find me mostly on Amazon. I am the author of Bait and Switch and The Painted Cat and a short story collection called A Fuzzy Place, which is a collection of short stories that I wrote when I was very deeply in the furry fandom that I think creates a very interesting narrative. You can also find me on Twitter at @eccentrictomboy.
Vera, what is new and exciting in your life?
Writing-wise, I'm in the process of editing the audiobook to my novel, Dreams of Fire, but that is currently in the works and that should be available later this year. Finally started getting back to something that I hope I can see through to the end, because one of the things that I went out of my way to be sure I did not include in my novel was a romantic subplot, because I can't stand them. I would remove them from about 95% of all stories if I had the power to do so. And I'm challenging myself to write a romance novel.
That is a challenge. That is definitely a challenge.
Like, I'm not against romance. I'm just rarely drawn to the romance genre. And so normally when I encounter it, it's a subplot in something else, and it's something I'm not here for. So despite that, I'm giving it a go, and I don't want to talk it up too much more than that on the off chance that I end up shelving it again. But that's what I'm currently working on.
Fantastic. I hope that making the romance the main plot and having everything else be subplot flips the switch and allows you to do this, because that's hilarious. So Vera, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, in terms of my writing, I have three published works. Under Vera Wild, you will find Skirting Gender, which was a book about my own discovery of my gender fluidity and also some advice in there. So it's a combination autobiography and advice book. There is When She Wakes, a BDSM story in two acts, which is a two-act play. Both of those are available on Amazon. Published under Nathaniel Wayne, that's still me, is Dreams of Fire, which is my fantasy novel. That came out last year. As for everything else I do, let me see if I can power all through this. You got to look for two main things. There is Council of Geeks, which you will find on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and Twitch, where I discuss and engage in various geeky activities. On Twitch, I game, and on YouTube, I talk about everything from Doctor Who to LGBTQ+ patterns and representation in media. And then there is Vera Wild. Wild is spelled W-Y-L-D-E, because I had to do as pretentious as I possibly could. And that is where I discuss more of my experiences as a gender fluid person. And you also find some, let's just go with spicier content under that name as well, which can be found on TikTok and YouTube and Twitter and some other places if you are inclined to look.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being on today, both of you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So, which pitch deserves a place in the Word Crash Hall of Infamy? You tell us. Tweet us at Word Crash Game and vote for your favorite story of the night. If you're listening on YouTube, remember to like and subscribe and get in those comments to tell us how you would tackle our questions today. Everything we talked about will be in the links below. Thank you for listening. I'm Megan, and this has been Word Crash, reminding you to always get creative.